This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, wine journalist Mira Honeycutt speaks with Paso Robles winemaker Dave McGee about his exclusive focus on white wines.
Out of the 300 or so wineries in the area, the vast majority are primarily focused on red wines. And it just seemed like there was a need and an opportunity to do something other than that.
Then, Grant Hillett, program coordinator at EcoSlow, talks about the nonprofit's victories, especially their annual Creeks to Coast cleanup.
Just this past year, we had over 800 volunteers, which was awesome, and they picked up close to 8,000 pounds of trash. That's in one day.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 9th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with Brian Reynolds' segment, Book Waves.
Hello. Today, we are joined by author and activist Lucy Bledsoe, who is the author of numerous books and campaigns for LGBTQ rights. She will be in the San Luis Obispo area on Saturday, June 14th at the Atascadero Library at noon, and at 4 p.m. on the same day, the 14th, at the San Luis Obispo Library Community Room. Welcome, Lucy.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write your latest book, Tell the Rest, and sort of how it fits into your current activities as an author and as an activist?
Sure. Happy Pride, everyone. It's an especially fun Pride for me because I came out exactly 50 years ago in 1975, which just makes me feel very old. I came out when I was two, but no, that's a joke. Anyway, so yeah, happy to be celebrating Pride with some books and also happy to be celebrating at the libraries in Atascadero and San Luis Obispo because librarians have been just so much on the front lines of freedom of information, fighting the book banning that this administration's trying to do. So I'm really happy to be pairing up with the libraries. My most recent novel is called Tell the Rest. It's about a couple survivors of conversion therapy. I'm decided that I wanted to write that book. It was hard to figure out what angle I wanted to come at it from, but I've been feeling so much rage at what's been coming out of Washington and the hate towards my LGBTQ community. And I just didn't know what to do with that. I know many people are feeling very immobilized by it. So I decided I wanted to write a story where I flipped that rage on its head and wrote about some characters who have already dealt with it. So this story is about surviving the trauma and thriving and coming back at it with solutions. So two main characters, one is a poet, Ernest, and I did a lot of research into happiness and how to deal with anger, and doing creative work is one path. So I wanted to give that to one of my characters, Ernest, and the other is a basketball coach. And my own personal story, I found my voice. I found so much goodness in a community of girls' basketball teams, working together for a common goal, a real sisterhood that way. So I use those characters to talk about how we can meet this moment we're all in right now.
You know, one of the things that I've studied a lot is, how to be a better person, how to be a piece of a larger puzzle that helps create a better world. And some of the experts I've consulted recently talk about negative emotions, in particular fear and anger, which are two sides of the same coin often, and how almost always when you're angry, at least during that time period, you lose your higher mental functions. It's as though, you know, your personhood stops at your shoulders and your head is disconnected because you're upset and you don't make good decisions. And so I certainly celebrate the idea of taking that rage and looking at it sort of clinically and turning it into something positive. And in fact, there's another theory that I really love about keeping your wits about yourself during a crisis, because pretty much every crisis has solutions buried in it if you can just keep your head and see, you know, what maybe other people don't see because you're a little bit calmer than them or a little bit more strategic. Does that make sense?
That makes so much sense. And when you talk about fear and rage being basically the same thing, or rage being a result of fear, I think it explains a lot about what's happening to these people who are now ruling our country. They're terrified. They're terrified of us, my community, people of color. So many people, women who are getting powerful roles, scares them so much that they're going on this full-on attack. And it's good to just note that, the comment you made, that, their rage is coming from their fear. So yeah, I mean, one thing that I really loved in writing Tell the Rest and trying to flip this whole thing on its head is I have a character who has a PhD in happiness studies. And that's a real thing, as it sounds like you know. And so he gets to talk to my characters about what he's learned about what makes people happy. And again, you know, community, biophilia, being in beautiful places, doing creative work, finding community, whether it's, you know, a church or a basketball team. So it was really fun focusing on that side of things.
Here's a factoid that I'm sure you're familiar with that is kind of startling to me. Well, two factoids together, that generally I've heard that the gay population, for every 100 people in the world or in this country, you know, maybe 10 to 15 are not heterosexual. It's a small number. And the number of trans is even smaller, maybe one or two. And then if you look at, say, trans athletes or people who might play on you know, their birth strengths to the disadvantage of the opposite gender, whatever. It's a tiny, tiny thing. And what do you make of the idea that so much fuss and hoo-ha is created? There are harmless neighbors of ours that need cherishing and not discrimination, but it seems like it's way blown out of proportion.
Absolutely. It's heartbreaking. The problem is they're getting traction with it. There are small groups of people in this country, or actually they keep saying 37% are like kind of MAGA people, which to me is way too big a number, but they're getting traction with those people, and fostering this hate works for them, unfortunately. What I've been saying to people, I've been doing a lot of town halls with not just the LGBTQ community, but about us and keeping us safe, asking allies, straight allies, to come and show up. And I think speaking up can work so well against this. When people ask, what can you do? I just try and tell people, just speak up. It doesn't even have to be eloquent. You know, if you hear someone make a homophobic remark or a hateful remark about a trans person, just say something, anything. Oh, wow, you know, I don't feel that way. Or that's my friend. And I think it will break down the power that has that they're using against us, because as we all know, they're doing much very grievous things while using this hate to fire people up. And yeah, the athlete thing, I mean, it's just a tiny, tiny percentage. Most trans athletes, greatest percentage, are not, you know, running away with the medals or anything like that. So it's a lot of lies.
When I was a public library director, I went to the local gala center and they have a library, and I said, oh, in my naivete, I said, let's do this is many years ago, 15, 20 years ago, probably. But I said, let's do an event between the gay community and the public library, and we'll celebrate each other, and we'll have food and drink and speakers. And the head of that group looked at me and said, Brian, nobody's going to come because they're afraid. They're embarrassed or afraid of, you know, even though, you know, their friends and family may know their status there in terms of that, but they just don't want to be recognized publicly as such. Or for such, maybe that was part of it. But so my question to you is, has that changed, and does it matter? In other words, is part of the solution more people who lean that direction coming out and linking arms with us in public settings? Is that part of the solution?
That's such a good question. And again, I came out in 1975 in the time of Harvey Milk, and he was famous for saying, come out, come out, come out. The more of us who come out, people find out their loved ones, their friends, their families. You can't hate your loved ones, or most people can't. A few people still find ways
to hate. You don't know my family.
Yeah, but and it was brilliant. So many of us came out back then, and I think it's very helpful. I don't know if it surprises me, but what I'm aware of now is that many, many young people are still very afraid to come out. You feel like there's Ellen DeGeneres, there's, you know, Pete Buttigieg, there's all these famous gay people are out. You'd think it would make it easier, but I think it doesn't. There's still the haters out there. Young people are young people, and to be bullied and have hateful stuff come at you is still very difficult. So yes, I think anyone who has the courage to come out, it's one of the best things you can do. Speak up wherever you can. That's why community is so important. That's why these town halls I'm having are so important, where we can find strength together, know that we have each other's backs, including our straight allies having our backs. It's community, 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 and alliance, alliance, alliance. And yes, coming out is so important. And also recognizing that it's the safety quotient is different for different people. You know,
right.
I had a supportive family. Some people don't. So, yeah.
In your career, let's say over the past few years as an author and as an activist, have you seen things change in the movement of recognition of our gay friends and neighbors and family, but also in not just the movement itself, but the society in which it's embedded? In other words, it seems like today we're in a much darker place than we were 5 years ago. What do you think?
Yeah, I think about that a lot, and it's hard to figure out because on one hand, we've made so much progress, and that progress is not gone completely. On the other hand, yes, the haters have so much license now to show it. And it's kind of cool now to be, you know, anti-woke, anti-queer, you know, but so it's sort of both. It's really hard to understand where we are. I know a lot of people in my generation feel devastated because we thought in the 70s and 80s, we had made so much progress and we were getting there and we were going to be free. And to see all this backsliding is just, it's really devastating. But I'm not giving up hope. I think we've made a lot of progress. A lot of us are still out there being courageous, speaking up, trying to support young folks, trying to support the trans community, and it will be okay, but there's going to be some pain along the way.
I recently watched a documentary. It was called A Black Mixtape. It's a Swedish documentary of the Black Power movement and the Panthers in the 60s and 70s. And it was tough to watch because the problems they're complaining about and angry about are not better 50 years later. I would like to remind everybody, I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on Issues and Ideas, KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by author and activist Lucy Bledsoe, who will be in San Luis Obispo for two programs on Saturday, June 14th at noon at the Atascadero Library on Capistrano Avenue and at 4 p.m. at the San Luis Obispo Library Community Room. One of my lodestones, Lucy, in my life, or I try to make it that way, maybe it has to do with the way I was raised and some troubles I had growing up, but I just cherish kids. I want them to be happy and healthy and go from the womb to healthy and happy adulthood, and you know that arc, that trajectory of human life. And so my view is whatever we can do as families, as neighbors, to help young people adjust to themselves and to their changes as they grow into adulthood is what we need to do, to identify in consultation with the young person and their family what it is they want and need, and then try to work to enhance that. That's not what's happening today. In the theme of your book, for example, about conversion therapy, I think one point of view, my point of view personal, as I go ahead and be honest about, is child abuse. What do you think?
It's absolutely child abuse. And one thing that enrages me so much is that most of the people doing this call themselves Christians. And it's about the most unchristian practice on the face of the earth. To take a young person, as you say, when they're vulnerable, when they're finding themselves, when their imaginations are active, tell them their hearts, their imaginations, their ways of loving are wrong and bad and evil and nasty. I can't think of a worse thing to do. It's one reason I chose that topic for my novel, Tell the Rest. I thought, I'm just going to go to the belly of the beast. I'm going to go to the very worst thing they're doing and talk about it and expose it. And it's not that different from some of the horrible things these folks say. It's a continuum. And conversion therapy is at the worst end of it. And they target young people because, I mean, one interesting thing I found, and I did a whole lot of research for this book and interviewed a lot of people who had been through it, and most of these young people knew at the time they were going through this process that it was just nuts, just crazy. You know, they'd have some pastors surrounding them, or in some cases, therapists telling them, you know, you're evil, you know, you need to get that evilness out of you. And there's a woman who's a city commissioner in Orlando, Florida, who had been through this. She's now healed from the trauma, and she's, yeah, a politician. And she said that the pastor stood around her and told her that her homosexual evilness would leave her in the form of an orange mucus. Oh. I mean, they literally told her this. And she knew at the time that was just nuts. But, you know, she's like 15. You know, you don't, she didn't know what to do with it. And even though you know it's wrong and nuts, it's still very harmful and painful. So yes, you're right. I mean, protecting our children, letting them grow up, being able to love and have their full imaginations, nothing can be more important. And that's why I wanted to attack this particular practice. You know, people are really surprised to learn there's 700,000 survivors of conversion therapy in the U.S.
Wow.
today. The practice goes undocumented because you don't have to have a license. There's no regulatory thing. You know, any church can do it in a basement. Any therapist can do it. You know, a parent can hire a therapist anywhere. So no one really knows how many people are going through this.
That's astounding to me.
I know.
My next question to you was going to be, in the last, say, 10 or 20 years as you've been working on this important effort, what have you seen that is surprising or that you didn't expect? To me, I mean, just that one tidbit of hundreds of thousands of young people suffering through this, I mean, that's just mind-blowing. Any other things that you still marvel at, lessons drawn that the rest of us need to pay attention to?
Yes. I mean, also the thing about the kids being so, it's so funny because, well, it's not funny, but, you know, there's these camps that they send kids to sometimes. And the thing I was saying a minute ago about, they knew this was ridiculous. And these camps, they're literally like praying away the gay during the day and then hooking up at night with their friends. It's like, you know, that sort of surprised me, the self-awareness of the young people, even as it did its harm. But the other thing that surprised me a lot is that many, many survivors of conversion therapy do not give up their faith. They remain Christians. They just find churches that are inclusive and support them as gay people. And that really surprised me. I just assumed there'd just be this like, throw it all out, be furious, which is the case with some survivors. But I kind of love that. I kind of love that it's a way of calling out, you know, this Christian hypocrisy, like, no, you know, Christianity or even the teachings of Jesus are not what is wrong. It's the way you people are using this that's wrong.
Let's take a generic family with a child who's growing up in a non-traditional heterosexual way. How many of those young people and their families stay intact throughout the process? Here's a personal example. My stepbrother, I don't know exactly when he realized he was gay. In his early 20s, this is many years ago, he called me up one night and said, I want to tell you and Diane, that's my wife, that I'm gay. And I'm worried about what you're going to feel or what the rest of the family is going to feel. And it all worked out, you know, favorably. But I just wonder how many families are broken by that.
That's a really good question. Another thing that surprised me, or didn't surprise me, was some of the most moving stories are parents who sent their kids to one of these practitioners to pray away the gay or to get the gay out of their kid, and who then realized how harmful the practice was for their child, and their love for their child overcame. And so they, you know, got the kid out. So there are many families that I heard about who they trusted their pastor. They thought, oh, the pastor says my kids, you know, has these traditionally feminine ways of being in the world and was born he, and so we have to take care of that. And the parents are like, oh, thank you, sir. You know, okay, we'll do that. And then they realize through the process that it's evil. So there's a lot of that. There are, of course, plenty of kids. I know I have a good friend, you know, her family doesn't speak to her to this day because she's gay. So it's gone both ways.
Have you found in the last few years your ability to get the word out on this important subject constrained? In other words, going to libraries and talking about this, as a former librarian, it makes my heart beat a little faster that we're in the vanguard of, you know, collectively and professionally, of making more people aware and understanding it and embracing it and the rest of it. But have your opportunities to get the word out shrinking, or have you faced any personal threats or pushback?
I have not found the opportunity shrinking. And I guess I haven't faced any pushback. My partner was a librarian for many, many years. So I love librarian, you know, doing these workshops in town halls and libraries is great because librarians have been so on the front lines. And so that's wonderful. But what I'm really trying to do in dealing with this time we're in, which is so, so challenging, so exhausting, so stressful, is to remember and connect with all the good people. There are so many amazing people. I mean, at least 50% of us, you know, yeah. And maybe more like 75% of us are good people, and not letting the bad actors inhabit my brain and my heart. And so that's what I'm trying to do. And I had a wonderful experience. My book that came out right before Tell the Rest, it's called No Stopping Us Now. And it's about a 90% true autobiographical story about what I did in high school around Title IX and some really difficult stuff that happened at my high school with the coaches there who didn't want me to get girls' sports in the schools. And I got to go last year and do a presentation at my high school, standing in the middle of that very gym with the entire 2024 student body around me and with complete support. And, you know, as this out lesbian who had written this feminist novel in Portland, Oregon. So I just try to stay connected to those moments and those people and encourage all of us to keep speaking out, keep supporting one another, form alliances across gender, sexuality, skin color. I've been doing a lot of intergenerational stuff, in part because of what you said about kids and how important that is. And that's where I try to go with that.
That's awesome. I would like to remind everyone that I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on Issues and Ideas, KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by author and activist Lucy Bledsoe, whose latest novel, Tell the Rest, is about trans conversion therapy and surviving that. She will be in the San Luis Obispo area Saturday, June 14th at the Atascadero Library at noon and at the San Luis Obispo Library Community Room at 4 p.m. Thank you so much, Lucy, and good work.
Thank you so much, Brian.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Up next is Wine Country with Mira Honeycutt, where she speaks with winemaker Dave McGee, owner of Monochrome Wines and founder of White Wine Invitational, that is happening on Friday, June 20th from 4 to 7 p.m. in Paso Robles. Dave talks to Mira about the motivation behind the Invitational and the world of white wines.
Summer is upon us, and it's time for refreshing white wines. Not just any whites. Whites that go beyond your usual Chardonnay, Pinot Grigio, and Sauvignon Blanc. We're talking about unique white wines. White varieties that are native to France, Italy, Spain, and Austria, and grown right here along the Central Coast by adventurous wine growers. Today, you'll hear about white varieties such as Uni Blanc, Torontis, Bourblanc, Picpoul Blanc, Vermentino, Gewürztraminer, and more from our guest, winemaker Dave McGee. He's the owner of Monochrome Wines, which is among a handful of Paso Robles wineries dedicated exclusively to white wines. Dave is also one of the founders of the upcoming White Wine Invitational, the Paso Robles Festival focused on unique white wines. Dave McGee, welcome to Wine Country.
Thank you, Mira. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Dave, Paso Robles is known for big, bold red wines. And in this sea of reds, you're an anomaly. As a white wine house, you make no reds, no rosés. Talk about your philosophy on white wines and the significance of the name Monochrome for your label.
Well, I decided to focus primarily, exclusively on white wines a number of years ago, and there were a few reasons for that. One is, as you point out, Paso has really been known as a red wine area, and so out of the 300 or so wineries in the area, the vast majority are either entirely or primarily focused on red wines. And it just seemed like there was a need and an opportunity to do something other than that. Also, for those of you who live in Paso or have visited, it gets pretty hot there a lot of the year. And I don't know about you, but when it's 105, the last thing in the world I want is a big burly Cabernet or Syrah or Zinfandel.
You're
so
right.
I think there's definitely
you.
A place for some good white wines. And I felt like not just any white wines, but really trying to make some quality white wines that would stand up against the world's best. And I think that's one of the trends you're seeing in Paso right now.
Your specialty is quality white wines, unusual white wines, and unusual blends. So you have an impressive science background, and I believe several patents to your credit. So what drove you to winemaking?
It was really something I started as a hobby initially when my wife and I were living up in the Bay Area.
In your garage?
Yes, in my garage.
Okay, you're a garagist then.
Yes, literally. And you know, I just did a lot of reading, started making wine in the garage, took the online version of UC Davis's winemaking program, and one thing led to the next, and long story short, my wife and I ended up moving down to Paso, and from there worked at a number of other wineries just to get my hands dirty, literally, and opened up Monochrome in 2016.
What made you choose Paso Robles? You were up in San Francisco. You could have gone to Napa, Sonoma.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Bakersfield, and my wife and I just came down here, and we loved it and decided to move and figure the rest out later. So it wasn't definite that I was going into wine at that point, but I felt like I needed to kind of get my hands dirty and figure out if it was something I really wanted to do. So I did that for a couple of harvests, working at a few other local wineries.
But you were familiar with Paso Robles.
Oh, definitely, yes. Yeah. And we came down here, as I said, and we loved it. We loved the wines and just thought it was a good change from the Bay Area.
Do you still dabble in your science projects?
Other than what I do at Monochrome, not really.
No. That's definitely a science project.
Yeah.
And we'll get to your winemaking philosophy, too. So here in Paso, winemakers are known to blend all sorts of grape varieties, right? But you go the distance, blending really unique and unheard of white grape varieties. Albeo Mayor, I heard from you, and we'll get to that, too. So first, you don't have vineyards. Where do you source such varieties? And second, when you're blending, before you settle on that final blend, how many different versions do you conduct before your palate says, aha, this is the one?
Well, as to the multiple varieties, I think that's one of the things that makes the Paso area so great for winemaking, and white winemaking in particular, is there are so many microclimates within a short distance, call it plus or minus 100 miles of Paso. And so it's possible to go everything from cooler climate areas where I can source Gewürztraminer, for example, which I do about 90 miles north of Paso, to much more warmer climate areas that would be suitable for things like white Rhone varieties. And so being able to pick and choose and find vineyards that are right for each specific variety is one of the really unique things about the Paso area. So I think that opens up a lot of opportunities, and it opens up a lot of opportunities for white winemaking generally, because Paso itself is a little bit warm, a lot of white varieties. But if you're willing to branch out, you can source a lot of other things from appropriate sites. So as for the blending, there are a few things that appeal to me about blending. One is I feel like it gives me more opportunity to come up with something unique and creative that isn't just the same old that have been done multiple times by other people. There's that, but I also feel like it gives you more opportunity to balance the wines better. So, for example, you might have some wine over here that's got great flavors and great aromatics, but it's just missing something. It's missing some acidity, it's missing some body, something. And you might have some components over here that can provide those things. So being able to take components from one area and apply them to something else to balance out the wine is one of the great things about blending. Now, you mentioned that I do a lot of that, and I make intentionally all the vessels differently, different fermentation temperatures, different types of yeasts, and so on and so forth. So in a typical vintage, I will make somewhere between 50 and 60 different wines and then blend those down to what become the final 8 blends. And so 50. That quickly becomes overwhelming.
Did you say 50 or
50 to 60 wines blended down to the final 8. And if you're wondering how many possible combinations,
yes,
the math, it's 1.22 billion. Now, I don't do all of those, but it definitely goes from being fun to being overwhelming in short order.
So at what point do you say, okay, stop, this is overwhelming?
Well, it usually goes through a number of phases. I think the first phase is you're excited, it's a new vintage, this is going to be cool. The second phase is you get overwhelmed and just despair because things aren't going exactly the way that you thought they would initially.
So do you give up and say, okay?
No, then you go and you kind of play with some things and you get to the hope phase, and then you cycle along between hope and despair a number of times, and then finally you get to success. And so it usually takes me 4 or 5 passes to get everything to fall into place. So it takes a number of weeks before I get all the blends worked out.
What a fascinating adventure. Now, you source from not just Paso Robles, but really up and down the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have an appellation, you call your wines California, because you have the freedom to go to Santa Barbara all the way up to Monterey.
Correct. Yeah, my rule of thumb is as long as I can get the fruit on a truck and get it here within about 3 hours of the time it was picked. In theory, that's almost Santa Cruz Mountains down to Santa Barbara. And yes, all of my wines are just appellated California, partially to reflect that, partially because they change every year. And so one year it being a Paso appellation, the next year it being a Central Coast appellation, I think would be confusing. And finally, I don't really see the point of appellating it Paso, for example, unless
right.
I'm claiming that I'm trying to make something that's representative of all the other wines in Paso, which is not what I do.
So when you source your wines, I've known you for a while now. I find it very interesting. Do the wine growers seek you out because they know you're a maverick and you're looking for a really different variety? Or do you know such and such grower is making such and such Spanish wine? Let's take an example of Albillo Mayor. I'm quite fascinated by that. I mean, how did you come upon that Spanish variety? How did you even know such a variety existed here?
Well, that was a bit of an anomaly because it came from Plum Orchard Lane Vineyard, which is in Paso. And Neil, the orchard vineyard manager there, called me up and said, and I had worked with him for a number of years at this point. He called me up and said, hey, I've got some Torontes here in Plum Orchard Lane. You want to come take a look at it? And I said, sure. So I went there and we looked at it and I looked at the end posts and it actually turns out it was Albillo Mayor. And I said, well, you know, Neil, this isn't Torontes, it's Albillo Mayor. And I'd never even heard of it at that point. But I did some research online and decided to give it a go. And so I've been working with that variety for probably the last three vintages, I think. That one was an anomaly. More generally, I would start off looking for climates that were appropriate for a specific variety I was interested in, and then try to find vineyards that had a good reputation and good farming practices, and then hope I could talk them into selling me some of it. More recently, I've had a number of vineyard managers and growers kind of ask me what I would like them to plant for me going forward, which is kind of nice.
So how much of that acreage is planted here?
I don't know of any other vineyards in the area that have Albillo Mayor except for Plum Orchard Lane. And I don't know the exact acreage, but I would guess it's somewhere between 1 and 2 acres.
So for people unfamiliar with such a variety, white variety, tell us a flavor profile of this wine.
You know, I think it has a little bit more texture and body than you would expect, particularly for something that never seems to get all that ripe. It rarely gets over about 21 bricks. So it usually is a little bit lower on the alcohol side, typically 12 to 13%, which is fairly low by California standards. But it has some nice kind of fruity flavor and, like I said, a lot of textural elements to it.
What was it blending mate in your current vintage and your current bottling?
It's changed a bit. I usually follow what's recommended in the Denomination Origin for Ribera del Duero, which is its homeland. The last version was Albillo Mayor with a little bit of Sauvignon Blanc. This one that I'm bottling in a couple of days has a little bit of Albarino in it as well.
I like that blend. If you're just joining us, this is Wine Country, and I'm Mira Honeycutt. Today, my guest is winemaker Dave McGee, owner of Monochrome Wines, one of the few wineries in Paso Robles focused exclusively on producing white wines. Dave, you also have a unique approach to your winemaking style that you call layering in vinification. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do when I started making white wines was kind of stand against the popular conception of white wines as being crisp, refreshing, but that's about it, you know, kind of easy drinking, sit out by the pool kind of things. And so I wanted to create white wines that had a little bit more complexity and layers and a little more going on with them. And the way I ended up doing that really derived from when I was first making wine in my garage and didn't know what I was doing. And so I figured I'd make a bunch of different versions, different fermentation temperatures, different types of yeast, different types of vessels, figure out what was the best way to do it, and then do it like that. But what I learned was having a lot of different versions that all had been done differently resulted in wines that had a little bit more character and complexity, in my opinion. So that's become how I make all the wines at Monochromes. I intentionally make about 4 to 6 different versions of each variety. And one might be more focused on certain flavors. One might be more on texture. One might be more on tannin or phenolics or aromatics. And then I have all those building blocks that I can use to assemble the blends.
And using different vessels, right, for fermentation?
Correct.
And,
yes. Most of the wine is made in used oak barrels, but I do use a few new ones occasionally.
Like what? What other vessels do you use?
I use some stainless barrels on occasion. I also have an amphora, which is a big clay pottery vessel. So I use that as well. And they all result in slightly different profiles of the wine that comes out of it. Different degrees of aromatics, different degrees of texture. And when you throw in different degrees of skin contact and things like that, it's really fascinating how you can have the same fruit from the same vineyard harvested the same day, and they all come out completely different. And it's part of why I never use the word terroir, because I don't know what that means. I'm not doing anything that isn't conventional winemaking in some part of the world. But again, starting with the same raw materials, it comes out completely different.
That's fascinating how you layer with different vessels and fermentation processes and all that. Let's talk about the White Wine Festival, which you are amongst one of the founders. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what is it. Is it a festival? Is it a seminar? Is it several events? And who are some of the participants we can meet when we come to the festival?
Well, first of all, I should point out that the White Wine Invitational is it is an event, but it is just part of an overall larger project where I'm working with 10 other wineries and winemakers and really trying to promote Paso white wines and really change the narrative from Paso being a red wine country exclusively, and that if white wines are made, they're sort of second-class citizens, to recognizing that there's some truly world-class white wines now being made in Paso, and there's definitely a growing momentum for a lot of the top winemakers to put more energy and more effort into trying to make really world-class white wines. And the other thing I think that's unique about this area is it's not like Sonoma or Napa where it's Chardonnay after Chardonnay after Chardonnay. You know, the group that's involved in this, it's everything from white Rhone varieties to Alsatian varieties to Italian varieties to Spanish varieties, and it's kind of all over the map, but they're all done extremely well. And this event is really one of the things we're doing to try to highlight that. And it's going to be held at Rava's Winery, which is a beautiful facility. And there'll be 11 producers there. We'll each be pouring somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, three or more wines. There'll be somewhere north of 30 of some of the best white wines in the Paso area that will be available for there. And there'll be food available for purchase, and there's going to be a live band and all that sort of thing. So it's June 20th, Friday evening from 4 to 7. You can get tickets online. They're $40 per person, which I think is a heck of a bargain for, you know, 30 or 40 of the best wines around. The other producers involved, well, the total list is, so Barton, Giornata, IIWI, which is a new one. So Phil LaMontagne, who had been the winemaker at TH Estate, this is his new brand, and he's making some terrific wines. Mm-hmm. Canero, which is one of Anthony Yount's personal brands. Lone Madrone, Monochrome, of course, Pisser Terre, which is Ryan Pease's brand. Rava, Rococo, which is part of the Willow Creek Wine Company. So Natalie Brown is the winemaker for that. And Tobless Creek, you know, you got to have them involved. They're certainly one of the pioneers of both whites and reds in the area. And Union Sacre as well. Okay. So it really was, we tried to select some of the real best producers in the area, and all of them make multiple white wines, which we felt was important so that consumers could go to these places and feel confident that they can taste at least a couple white wines when they visit.
So that's June 20th, mm-hmm. 4 to 6 p.m.
Correct.
At Rava Wines. It's called White Wine Invitational. Is it a benefit for a local organization?
Yes. The net proceeds are going to MUST Charities. Basically, it's entirely for charity.
Is there a website people can go to if they want tickets or more information?
So you can get the tickets at Rococo, their website, and then you just go into the events area, and then you can purchase tickets there. Mm-hmm. And as I said, they're $40 per person, and that gets you access to all the wines, and the winemakers are going to be there, so you'll have a chance to not only taste some great wines, but speak with the winemakers personally.
Anything else you'd like to add about unique white wines in this area before we say goodbye today?
I think it's really an up-and-coming field, and I think it's astonishing how many good white wines are being made these days. And I think we're hoping to not only make that more widely known in the wine community, but also to encourage more winemakers and wineries in the area to put more energy and effort into making excellent white wines. There's a lot of progress going on in that field, but the other thing that we hope to do is encourage more vineyard owners to plant white fruit in their vineyards. And part of that is because of the more recognition and higher prices for the white wines, that makes that more attractive to them.
That's great. Thank you, Dave, for joining us today. You are listening to Paso Robles winemaker Dave McGee, owner of Monochrome Wines, a brand focused exclusively on white wines. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Mira Honeycutt, and this is Wine Country.
Next, the Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo, or ECOSLO, was established in 1972, and since then has been running multiple programs in SLO County, from cleanup to nature awareness to tree planting. Their annual fundraiser is happening this Saturday on June 14th at the Octagon Barn from 4 to 8 p.m., and tickets are on sale at ecoslo.com. I speak with Grant Hillit, Program Coordinator at ECOSLO, about the work they do and why environmental cleanup matters. Welcome, Grant.
Thank you for having me.
Can you expand on ECOSLO's history and just talk to us about some of its programs?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, we've been around since 1972, so over 50 years now, one of the longest running environmental organizations in all of SLO County. We got our start doing a lot of recycling programs. We actually ran the county's recycling center for several decades before that was taken over by the county and the IWMA, the Integrated Waste Management Authority, who we still partner with to this day. Since then, we've done a whole number of things, from a study we did in the 90s around farm worker and environmental health with pesticides. We've done lots of advocacy over the years, but these days we're really focused on primarily core programs. Those include, like you mentioned, cleanups. We do several cleanups throughout the year, quite a few. We have one big cleanup, Creeks to Coast, in the fall every year. We also do our urban tree planting programs. We just finished up with our tree planting season, where we planted over 80 urban trees throughout the city of San Luis Obispo.
Wow.
Yeah, and then we also run the SLO County Green Business Network. We hold that chapter.
Can you talk to us a little bit more about the Green Business Program?
That's one of our newer programs. It's part of a statewide network where we work with local businesses, usually small to medium-sized businesses, to help them go above and beyond minimum state requirements and showcase the community, how they care about the environment, and also help them save money a lot of the time by working to reduce their water bills, their electrical bills, and cook them in with lots of resources like 3C REN, the Tri-County Regional Energy Network, which is a new municipality that we partner with on this program.
Can you give us an example of a business that you helped so that we have a specific understanding of the program?
Yeah. So one of our newest certifications is Science Discovery. They're an environmental education group that actually works with the IWMA, and we're really excited to have them certified. We have over 30 businesses certified throughout the county. So that includes businesses such as the SLO Food Co-op. We have businesses like SLOCO Health and Wellness, Hive Beauty. And we also have All Good is a certified green business, and they make a bunch of really awesome health and beauty products. So we do kind of all sectors. We've got vet offices. We have a dentist certified. We kind of do it all.
What does the certification help people achieve?
Part of it is a way to signal to the community that you care about the environment, but there's also a bunch of other benefits. So things like press and networking we do with green businesses, but we also have a lot of resources that we help to tie businesses into. A lot of it is helping them find things like, for example, the Tri-County Regional Energy Network and their Commercial Energy Savings Program. We work to tie them into that to save money on upgrading their electrification, looking at their power bill, things like that. We also help to tie them into the IWMA to look at their waste and how maybe they're using trash cans that are too big, or maybe they don't have a green waste in this day and age, which is something with SB 1383 all businesses are required to do. So we work to kind of help them hook into those resources to help them lower their bills and also just run a greener, friendlier company.
Is that free of cost?
It's completely free. Yeah, so it's completely free. It's checklist-based, and it's very individualized. We understand that every business is different. Every business has different needs, and we want to work with them to partner with them to help find how we can meet their needs and get them certified.
Let's talk about your annual fundraiser. It's coming up on Saturday, June 14th from 4 to 8 p.m. What can people expect at the event, and what do the funds raised help you do?
It's our first annual fundraiser we've done. Our executive director, Kendra, has done a lot of really amazing work.
First ever?
First in my time. I think we used to do one before COVID and the pandemic, and then I know things kind of shifted then, but it's our first kind of big new one, which we're really, really excited about. It's going to be at the Octagon Barn, like you mentioned, And there's going to be a bunch of awesome stuff going on, or we've got food, dinner, drinks. There's local music from local artist Jack Milstead on the guitar. Sandy Sigurdsson is going to be our MC, and we're going to have a couple really awesome speakers. Mary Erica Stewart and Andy Pease will be talking. And there's going to be a silent auction, which we're really excited about. We've got a lot of really awesome donations from some of our sponsors. And then a dessert dash, which is a really exciting thing that I've never heard of before. But
sounds
Kendra,
delicious.
Yeah, Kendra told me about it, and it's really exciting. As far as where the funds are going to go, they're going to help EcoSlow expand our programming. So it's going to help fill in some of the gaps for how we can expand our urban tree work, how we can expand our cleanups, and target more communities in the county than we currently do. We're always looking to expand. We are a SLO county-based organization. So while I mentioned we plant a lot of trees in the city of SLO, we're always looking for ways to plant trees in the entire county. Same goes with cleanups. We always want to do more work in those, especially harder to reach areas of the county, areas that can oftentimes fall through the cracks. And so fundraisers like this help us do work in those communities and target those communities.
What are the current environmental challenges facing San Luis Obispo County?
The stuff we really focus on in terms of our challenges are really trying to – the challenges around funding and work with helping those communities, like I mentioned, that can kind of fall within the cracks. So we're always trying to do tree planting work, in particular – in communities throughout all of SLO County that are, say, unincorporated areas that can oftentimes not have the resources or the funding available as some place like a municipality like the city of San Luis Obispo, which has a really strong tax base that they can use to fund awesome programs like Keys for Trees, which we really, really love. But one of the biggest challenges we find is that some of those other communities can kind of fall behind and not have those resources. So that's one that we're really keenly aware of and always trying to find new ways to help out those communities. A lot of the new alternative energy infrastructure going in is something that I think a lot of people have their attention on. But really, I'd say for us and kind of what we focus on, it's going to be things like working to plant trees in new areas and things like that.
But what are the environmental related challenges? Is there, for instance, loss of tree cover, the water table is decreasing, plastic pollution? What are the main things we should be concerned about?
So I'd say definitely things like you mentioned, obviously plastic pollution's a global issue that we definitely feel the impacts of. One of the things that we're always looking to do is work with folks like the Integrated Waste Management Authority, the IWMA, to educate on how to properly recycle. That's always like a big challenge, I find. So they are the ones who run kind of point on all the recycling and solid waste management in the county. So definitely plastic waste is a big issue that impacts us locally. You mentioned tree cover, and I talked about that a little bit earlier. That's an issue where we're kind of catching up from years of decreased tree cover in urban areas. We're kind of playing catch up on that. So areas where tree cover is removed or not considered when urban areas were built, we're kind of having to go in and play catch up on that. And then absolutely, water table stuff I know is a really long-term thing that a lot of people are really, really concerned about. Some of the work we try and do with our cleanups is always targeting how can we remove waste up and down the water table and up and down the watershed and how we can remove it at various points. Yeah, those are definitely all big concerns. There's quite a lot. SLO County is a big county, and I would say there's oftentimes environmental issues that are unique to each individual community, such as the Oceano Dunes is an ongoing challenge. The air pollution down there has been caught up in court for a really long time, and it's been unfortunate the way that's gone down in some of the court rulings, but that's something that's been on our radar for decades and decades.
If you're just joining us, I'm Meher Ali speaking with Grant Halit, Program Coordinator at the nonprofit EcoSlow. Their annual fundraiser is happening on Saturday, June 14th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Octagon Barn. You can buy tickets at ecoslow.org/fundraiser. Can you share a milestone victory for EcoSlow that underscored its need in the community?
I would say our big milestone is kind of every year when we do our big Creeks to Coast cleanup. That's kind of one of the main things we always look at is the sheer amount of waste we're still collecting. I think a lot of people think, you know, hey, we're a clean community, we're getting better, and there's less waste now. We know more than we did decades ago. But, you know, just this past year, for example, we had over 800 volunteers, which is awesome, and they picked up close to 8,000 pounds of trash, a little over 7,800 pounds of trash. So that's in one day. Yeah, that's at 30 sites all across the county, but we pick up thousands of pounds of trash every year there. And so that's something where I think we think that we've come a really long way, but we still regularly pick up a ton of waste and a ton of trash. And it's always a great feeling, but we know we're going to be picking up thousands of pounds of trash again the next year. So in addition, we recently passed over 400 trees planted in our entire urban tree planting program since that pass was created in 2019. That was really big for us, and we're really excited about that. We've planted trees all across the county. Those are our kind of two big milestones for us in our volunteer programs.
Curious to know, when you collect so much trash, how long does it take you to sort through it?
We sort through the day of. So, yeah, every year we're sorting through the trash day of there. Unfortunately, the vast majority of it is trash and not recycling because a lot of it's contaminated. One of the big challenges in terms of recycling education is understanding that if you put contaminated recycling in the recycling, it's going to be sorted down the line ultimately as trash. If you're picking up, say, at a beach and you find a bottle, even if it's a glass bottle, but it's full of sand and water, that's ultimately going to have to be considered contaminated waste. So we sort it right then and there, and it's a little easier than you'd think. If anything, it's almost a bummer that you'd like to be able to spend more time, but so much of that waste winds up being contaminated that most of it ultimately goes in the landfill. So we sort it all then and there, and that's part of the whole cleanup.
Talk to us a little bit about your own connection to EcoSlow. When did you get involved with the organization and why?
I'm a lifelong resident of Slo County, grew up out in near Avila, and have spent my whole life here. I volunteered with EcoSlo when I was much younger. I did some cleanup stuff in high school. And so when they had a position open, I was really eager to apply for it and was really excited to be able to join the organization. And I've been here now for over 5 years, and my role has changed quite a lot over the time here. And I've settled into program coordinator, where I lead a lot of the administrative day-to-day stuff for our tree plantings and our green business program. So I help things like picking the sites and working with the city arborist, Walter Galt, who's phenomenal, the work he does for the city of Slo. We work together to find locations and species and things like that. So I'm doing kind of the minutia of the day-to-day, grant applications, things like that. But yeah, I've been here my whole life in Slo, and I hope to remain a lifelong resident of Slo.
The current administration has brought in many policy changes related to the environment. Have any of those had a direct impact on EcoSlo?
I would say the biggest impact we felt as an organization is around the funding crunch. I'd say a lot of nonprofits have felt the funding crunch, and we are certainly no different. Budgetary challenges usually flow from the federal level to the state level to county to city, et cetera. And so we've definitely felt, you know, the belts tightening. I think a lot of organizations, even private companies, can speak to that. Of course, we were really excited to see like the Chumash Sanctuary be approved before things shifted, which is awesome to see. We're really focused on the Slo County side of environmental issues and what we do. So I would say that in general, we really stick to focusing on Slo County issues. So in terms of that, I would say that there are other organizations who can probably speak more towards the broader national environment. But I would say funding-wise has probably been the single biggest challenge that we have faced with, like I said, a lot of nonprofits, even private businesses.
How can people support EcoSlo?
So there's two ways to do it. Of course, you mentioned our fundraiser, and donations are always welcome. We always love to have community members become involved. And the biggest one, though, ultimately day-to-day, I would say, is volunteering. We have a really great stable of volunteers, and we always love to add to that. There's tons of ways to volunteer with EcoSlo. If you're interested in a one-time thing, you can come out and do a tree planting or come out and do a cleanup. We have all of those events on our website, ecoslo.org/events. We have a bunch of great volunteer opportunities coming up. In fact, we have several coming up in July. We do cleanups every year post July 4th. That's always a really big one, where we do cleanups typically at Cayucas and Pirates Cove, Cave Landing area near Avila. So those are always really great opportunities. But we always take folks from one-time folks who want to come out and do a cleanup or tree planting, all the way down to we have a lot of repeat volunteers for our, we call them tree keepers. And those are folks who literally adopt a tree, care for it with our support, and they usually adopt a tree for a minimum of a year, and they help water it. They let us know if it needs new assistance that they can provide, mulch, tree stakes, ties, things like that. And we really, really rely on those folks, and those folks are key to our program existing and our ability to take care of over 400 trees that we currently have within our system. So those are really the two, I would say, main ways to support us. Of course, we always love donations. And then the big one is, yeah, volunteering. We're always looking to do new volunteers, and we've had really awesome turnout this year. I believe for our tree plantings, we averaged somewhere around 45 to 50 volunteers, which was huge.
What is the one thing that you're looking forward to in the fundraiser that's coming up?
I am very excited about the dessert dash. This was a new thing for me. Like I said, it's kind of a fun little like game. If you want to learn more, come to the event. Tickets are limited, but we're going to take more.
Can you give us a teaser?
It's basically like a team game where you get priority on desserts. So we're going to explain the whole thing. It's very exciting. Like I said, if you're interested in learning more, please come to our event, our Slow Sis fundraiser. Like I said, tickets are a little limited, but we are all still accepting folks to come. So that's probably the thing I'm most excited about.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
If you're interested, go to ecoslow.org/events and check out what we've got coming up. And of course, you know, keep our upcoming Creeks to Coast cleanup on your radar, September 20th. We're looking to get even more volunteers this year. We got 800 last year. We're looking to get more. So that's a big one. There's going to be over 30 sites across the county. And so there's going to be opportunities from North County, Templeton, Paso Robles area, all the way down to Napomo. So even if you might not think you can make it to a site, chances are there's one much closer to you than you think.
Grant, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
That was Grant Halit, Program Coordinator for the nonprofit EcoSlow, speaking about the nonprofit's annual fundraiser and its work in San Luis Obispo County. Their annual fundraiser is happening on Saturday, June 14th from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Octagon Barn. You can buy tickets at ecoslow.org/fundraiser. This is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali. Up next is a story from the California Report about food insecurity facing Central Coast farm workers. Katie Brown reports.
For nearly two decades, Ann Lopez has been advocating for better living and working conditions for Central Coast farm workers no matter the season. Each month, her organization, Center for Farmworker Families, distributes food in Watsonville. On this sunny Friday, she got a flat tire on her way to the event.
Okay, muy bien. Gracias.
No, de nada, no problem.
Oh my God, you guys. You don't have to call AAA, nothing. You know, this is the kind of reception you get in this kind of a neighborhood, which is poor, yes, but look what people do for each other.
A National Agricultural Workers Survey estimated nearly 25% of farm workers were living below the poverty line before the pandemic. That's when Lopez started these events.
I found a family hungry in this community, and the kids were crying because they were so hungry. And I thought, we're not going to do this. This is immoral. And then it turned out the whole community was like that. So that's when we called the food bank.
Second Harvest Food Bank was among several organizations that provided food for the first event 6 years ago. Now, over 20 organizations pitch in with items like clothes, toiletries, toys, and household goods. Sometimes as many as 400 families have turned out. This time, roughly 90 showed up. Ernestina, who's asked us not to use her last name, is a retired farm worker who has worked with Lopez for 14 years. She says fear of immigration and customs enforcement stopped many people from coming today.
El temor no nos deja progresar a veces.
She says fear doesn't let us move forward. Today, many families missed out because there were rumors of ICE. Because of that, who would even show up? Who knows? While people are scared, they also need to have food at home. Fear of the Trump administration's deportation goals means for some farm workers, picking up food here is one of the few places that they feel comfortable going other than work. Ernestina says it's hikes in rent and groceries that keep them coming. The American Farm Bureau estimates half of farm workers don't have proper documentation. Isabel is one of them and also asked us to only use her first name. She has three kids under the age of 10, came to California almost a decade ago, and has worked in the fields every season since she turned 18.
A veces hasta ir la tienda nos da miedo y nomás es como...
She says there are times when even going out to the store is scary. And right now, it's go to work, go home, get food, and go back home. We really don't go out, like to go to the park with my kids, to the store, or even go out and eat with the kids. Another direct relief group that Second Harvest supports is Pajaro Valley Loaves and Fishes. Ashley Bridges is the executive director.
We have such an abundance of fresh produce, organic produce, but access to that is sometimes very difficult. It is also very expensive.
Farmworker families are a big chunk of who they serve. About 120 meals a day and 1,200 food bank baskets a month go out to people who are food insecure. More than half of those folks are farm workers.
We saw a huge dip in participation January 20th, and then people started coming back to get services.
Now, with people working the spring harvest, Loaves and Fishes is seeing less foot traffic. Still, they're bracing for what's to come.
People are starting to go back to work, so we naturally slow down about this time, and that bulks the stereotype that people, once people start getting assistance, that they're stuck on it, and that is definitely not true here.
But when the season's over and needs increase, she says food will still be there.
That was Katie Brown, a reporter at KAZU 90.3, and her story was sourced from the California Report. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. Follow us on Instagram at KCBXFM. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.